The Chris DeGaul Show. The Chris DeGaul Show.
Talk Radio 1210.
WPHD.
Ray Dittinger, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Hold him high. Hold him high. You got him? The New Eagles Encyclopedia. How about that beast? Am I right? That's great. Thank you all. Thank you all for coming out, first of all. And I really hope you you enjoy the Eagles Encyclopedia. It was a lot of fun to put together. I had discussions with the folks at Temple University Press who published it about whether we should put out a new edition this year. We talked about it last season. And the reason we decided to do it, I'm sure a lot of you are aware, there was an original Eagles Encyclopedia that came out in 05, right after the Super Bowl in Jacksonville. And we had talked about, well, somewhere down the line, we'll probably do an updated version. But we never really determined exactly when. And I said to them last year, I said, I think it's time. I think it's time. I think this feels like a new era of Eagles football. You know, you got a new coach, you got a new quarterback, new sense of energy. And I had a feeling that this team was going places. And I said, I think next year, next September, would be a good time to come out with this book. So now the problem with that plan was I only had 7 weeks to write the book. So it became a little bit more of a hurried project than I thought. But I do think the timing was right. I do think this was the year for it. And I hope maybe this time next year we'll be selling a Super Bowl edition.
First of all, I got to say, I don't know how many of you have experienced this. This is the first time for myself, and I brought the boys along tonight, Ray. But how about the Philadelphia Eagles, our hosts tonight? How about a hand for them and the Touchdown Club? I don't know how rare a thing it is. I've never done it ever in all the years that I've been in broadcasting and been with sports teams. I've never walked through a locker room before. I've been down on a field a couple of times, but I've never seen the locker room before. That's a pretty cool experience.
Very nice experience. You get a kick out of that?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. This is a beautiful stadium. It really is. I mean, I've been all around the NFL. I've seen pretty much everything that's out there. And in terms of the facilities for the players, for the fans, this is right there with the best of them. It really is a great stadium, and I give a tremendous amount of credit to Jeff Lurie for coming in here and building the NovaCare complex and building this brand new stadium, because 20 years ago, I never thought it would happen. I really didn't. To get things done in this city, to cut through all the political red tape, to get it done, I mean, I thought they might get one or the other. I really didn't know they'd get both, but they did. And that's a credit to great ownership. And they have a really good stadium right now, and they have a really good team to play in it. So it's a good time to be an Eagles fan.
You bet it is. I always wanted to know how this felt, Ray. How many of you tonight are here as a gift from someone else?
Oh,
you're a
goodness.
Gift, Ray. You're
about
someone's gift, for Pete's sakes. How big is that?
Boy, I hope I'm not a big disappointment to you.
What's your exchange rate, by the way? Is a full refund available?
Well, I'm not kidding. I really am gratified with everybody that came out. When they talked about doing this event, I had no idea who was going to come. When they told me, it sold out in 2 days, which surprised me. But I think it has, honestly, I think it has more to do with the level of excitement in the city about this team.
Well, and you know why, too.
People really think this team can go places, and you know what? I think they can.
I say that you're the smartest man in football, and this happens to be the smartest audience in all of radio, so it just makes sense that it would sell out in 2 days. It seems to me a match made in heaven. That's all I say. All right, let's get right down to it. A lot of you have a lot of questions. Those of you that submitted questions, thank you. We're going to get to them, I promise, in due course. But I want to drill down a little bit because we don't ever have the time in the morning, Ray, to really get to know you. We talk a lot about the game previous or the one coming up. But how about you? Can you take us back to your roots in Philadelphia? I was talking with a gentleman here tonight. In fact, he said this is the first time he's been in this facility.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to this facility, though, he was a season ticket holder all the way back to Franklin. I mean, he's been doing this for a very long time.
Right.
How about you? When did you really become fully engaged and reporting and studying the Eagles?
A long time. most of you have your books now, right? Okay. Turn to the inside back cover, the back flap. And look at the little picture at the bottom.
There he is, little Ray.
That's me.
That's me as a 10-year-old at the Eagles training camp in Hershey in 1956, getting my picture taken with Chuck Bednarik. So when you ask how far back I go with this team, I go that far. That picture is very special. I didn't even know that picture existed. It was in our family for years. I never knew it existed until my father passed away. And we were cleaning out the house. And actually, my wife was cleaning out the house and going through his desk. And she found an envelope with some pictures. And she called me in and she said, "I think you want to see this." And the picture she held up was that one. And I didn't have any remembrance of it at all. But Maria didn't even know who it was. She said, "It's a picture of you with an Eagles player." I said, "No, it's a picture of me with the Eagles player." And so when we did the new version of the book, I said, "You know, there are a lot of things I want to get done in this book, but one of the things that has to happen is that picture has to be in there somewhere." So that's very special to me. So I grew up in the city. My parents were season ticket holders from the time my dad came back from the war, literally. It was like the first thing he bought when he got back were season tickets for he and my mom. I started going to games when I was 9 years old, going to training camp when I was 10. So, I have a long history with this team, and it allowed me to write this book, honestly. I mean, it was like writing my family's life story. It really was. It's as much about my family as it is about football.
So, Ray, you may have already answered this, but that was one of the first things I thought about when I was on the way in. Ray Didinger, who's literally covered this team his entire life, who do you identify as the, historically to this point, who is the consummate Eagles player? Who's the guy you say is the standout perennial Eagles star of all time?
I would say it's Bednarik. I think there are three players. This is purely my opinion. You feel free to disagree. I think there are three players that are kind of on a plateau above everybody else. I think there's Bednarik. I think there's Steve Van Buren. And I think there's Reggie White. I think that's the
Agreed.
Top of the pyramid. And then, you know, after that, then you get into another group of really good players, including the guy who was my favorite and my boyhood hero is Tommy McDonald. He would be in that next tier of guys. But if you ask me who's at the very, very top, I think it would be Bednarik, Van Buren, and White. And if I had to say why Chuck number one, he played more seasons than anybody in the history of the franchise. He played 14 seasons. He only missed three games in 14 seasons. And in most of those 14 seasons, and you know the older guys here, you know where I'm going with this. He played every play. I mean, he played both ways. He played 60 minutes for most of his 14 seasons. He was the center on offense. He was a linebacker on defense, and he also snapped for punts and place kicks. The only time he wasn't on the field was when there was a kickoff. And by the way, sometimes he kicked off. So, I mean, there were games where he literally played every play. And not just played every play, he was the best damn player on the field. And I still think what he did in 1960 is one of the most astonishing athletic feats ever. I mean, he was 35 years old and played both ways for a championship team. 35 years old, the oldest player on the team, and when they played the championship game against the Packers, he was the oldest player on the field.
Wow.
He played every snap of that game, and at the end of the game, when it came down to the tackle of the great Jim Taylor to save the game and save the season, Bednarik's the one that tackled him at the 8-yard line. One of the things about sports is things grow over time in the retelling. We all know that. You know, how somebody will tell a story, and over time it gets bigger and bigger. And you hear about, you know, the 500-foot home run that when you actually see it, it was 380, you know. the shot, he shot it the whole length of the court, you know. And then you see the film, and he was at the top of the foul line, you know. I mean, in the retelling, everything grows. I think the Bednarik story is unique in that his actual accomplishment is greater than the myth that surrounds it. If you look at what he did, it's as great as you think it is. If you break it down and you watch the film and you consider he did it at the age of 35, it's greater than the legend of Concrete Charlie. So if I had to pick one, he's the one.
there is always discussion. You talk about those heritage players, and I think we might have even talked about this briefly on the show before. Are they made of a different stock than guys that play today?
They're hungrier. I think that's for sure. They played in the truest sense. They played for the love of the game because there wasn't much money in it. Back in those days, when I'm saying those days, I'm not necessarily meaning the 40s. I'm meaning well into the 60s. Guys had to have off-season jobs. They would play professional football, and then when the season ended, they went off and they were substitute school teachers, or they sold insurance, or they sold beer, or they, some of them got manual labor jobs. But they had to have another job to support their families. That's literally true. And these are even the great players. I'm not just talking about the bottom of the roster guys, even the great players. I'll give you an example. This isn't an Eagle story, but it applies to what Chris asked me. 1958, those of you that might be old enough to remember, was what they called the greatest game ever played. The New York Giants and the Baltimore Colts played the NFL championship game at Yankee Stadium, and it was the first game that ever went to sudden death overtime. And it was the NFL championship game, goes to sudden death overtime. Can you imagine? First time anybody had ever seen sudden death overtime. The game was tied at the end of regulation, and the players didn't even know what was going to happen next. The players literally were looking at each other saying, what now? Really? It's high in the championship game? And then they walked the captains out to the middle of the field, flipped the coin, and, oh, we're still playing. And that was the first sudden death game. And it just galvanized the nation. People were just caught up in the drama. They had never seen anything like this before. And it was a game between the Baltimore Colts and the Giants, and I think there was something like 16 future Hall of Famers between the two teams. Unitas, Lenny Moore, Gino Marchetti, Frank Gifford, Andy Robustelli. I could go on and on. They were two of the greatest teams ever, and they're now playing sudden death overtime for the championship of the world. I mean, you can't get much more dramatic than that. Oh, and by the way, in Yankee Stadium. When the game, Baltimore Colts win the game, and the next day, they've won the NFL championship, right? The next day, Johnny Unitas, who was the MVP of the game, the quarterback of the Baltimore Colts, went to work at Bethlehem Steel. That was his off-season job. He worked at Bethlehem Steel. And I don't mean as a salesman. I mean, he worked in the steel mill. He wins the NFL championship, wins the MVP award on Sunday night. Monday, he's got his lunch pail going to Bethlehem Steel in Baltimore. Gino Marchetti, who was a defensive end, was setting pins in his brother-in-law's bowling alley. These are some of the greatest players in the league, and yet they had to have off-season jobs. So that's the biggest difference. The guys today are making enormous amounts of money, and I think they all do love the game. I think you kind of have to play it at this level. But back in that day, you really had to love the game because the financial reward was not there.
So did it make it more exciting to watch than today?
I don't know. Today's game is really good. I think when you talk about the quality of the athlete, the caliber of the athlete, today's athletes are better. I mean, you keep hearing the bigger, faster, stronger thing. Oh, the athletes are bigger, faster, stronger. They are. They are. I mean, when I go to training camp or I watch practice or I'm down in the field and I watch these guys run around, it's really stunning to see. It's stunning to see a guy who's 250 or 260 pounds run like a sprinter, and that's what they do. There are no slow people on this field. Even the big men can really move. And that's one of the big differences. When I was at NFL Films, I worked at NFL Films for 12 years, and you look at the old footage. Yeah, I mean, the thing that jumps right off the screen at you is the speed of the game has changed tremendously. Back in the day, I mean, there were big, heavy guys who didn't move very much. I mean, they just kind of planted themselves, and if the play came their way, they made the play, and if the play went that way, they just waved goodbye. in the NFL today, you can't do that. I mean, everybody's running, everybody's flowing, and if you can't run, you can't play. And so that's the thing, is the caliber of the athlete that's playing on Sundays, it's remarkable. I mean, these guys are the best athletes in the world.
Maybe the answer is obvious when you talk about the year we go to the Super Bowl, but if that's not the answer, then my question is, the greatest overall season this team has ever had, complete, start to finish, in terms of the roster, the way they executed, coaching staff? Was it that Super Bowl year, or was there a different year in your mind?
It would be. Boy, I hate to go back this far, because so many, it's going to be lost on so many people in the audience. In fact, maybe everybody in the audience. The greatest team the Eagles ever had, the greatest season they ever had, was 1949.
Ooh,
1949, because that team was 11-1. They were the defending world champions. They were the defending world champions. They had won it in 48. They came back in 49 and were even better because they drafted Bednarik. They had won it in 48 without him. In 49, they drafted him. He was a rookie out of Penn. So you already had a world championship team, and you added Chuck Bednarik to it. And so in 49, they went 11-1, just rolled through the league. And then they played the NFL championship game. They played a great Los Angeles Rams team out in Los Angeles and beat them 14-0. And it was actually much more one-sided than that. And they are still, to this day, little-known fact. I'm full of these little-known facts. Little-known fact is that the Eagles are still, to this day, the only team in NFL history, that team, to win back-to-back world championship games by shutout.
Did you know that?
That had never happened before, and it's never happened since. In 1948, most of you have seen the pictures of that great snow game, the blizzard game up at Connie Mack Stadium. Who knows? Maybe some of you might have been there. The Eagles beat the Chicago Cardinals in a blizzard up at Connie Mack Stadium 7-0 to win their first world championship. The next year, they come back and play in the championship game against the Los Angeles Rams and win that one 14-0. So in back-to-back championship games, they didn't give up a point. No one had ever done it before, and no one's ever done it since.
1949. Okay.
Now
which
let me
brings us to 2014.
No. And let me just I'll follow up just very quickly. The 1960 team, which is the last team to win it, and I think probably some of you here probably do remember that one, was an unusual team in that it was a bunch of guys that kind of were thrown together almost. They were a real underdog team. The 49 team was a great team. I mean, an all-time great team. The 1960 team was just kind of one of those teams that got a little magic. You know, they had a couple of really good players. They had Bednarik, they had Van Brocklin, they had McDonald. I mean, they had some good players, but a lot of the guys were kind of average players that had been cut by other teams and picked up on waivers. But they just got some magic that year. Sometimes you see it happen. You know, a team just gets on a roll, and they get a few breaks, and they win a few games. And that team ran off. They started the season losing to the Cleveland Browns 42-24. The opening game of the season was at home against the Browns, and they got beat 42-24. And I remember sitting in the stands of my parents saying, really? This is what kind of season it's going to be? And they went from there, and they won the next 9 games. And they just got better and better by the week. And then they go to the championship game, and they draw Green Bay Packers, coached by Vince Lombardi, a team that had 11 future Hall of Famers on that team. Think about that. That one. Now, one team, they had 11 future Hall of Famers on that team that the Eagles played that day at Franklin Field. And the Eagles beat them 17-13. It was the only postseason game Lombardi ever lost. He went the rest of that decade, never lost another postseason game, never lost another playoff game, never lost another championship game or a Super Bowl. He only lost one postseason game in his life as a coach. And it was to the Eagles at Franklin Field that day in 1960.
You see, that brain is why this book is so damn big. You know that, don't you? Ray, how about the coach? How about the great – we hope we're watching him right now, by the way. But how about, for your money, the greatest coach this franchise has ever had?
To be fair, I would have to say the greatest coach, and I'm going to go back to the 40s again, is Greasy Neal, who won the 2 back-to-back championships. He's the only Eagles coach that's in the Hall of Fame. He is in Canton. And so for that alone, I think I kind of have to say him. But that's before most of your time. But he was a great coach. I mean, he was an innovator. He brought some things to the offense and the defense that were way ahead of their time. I mean, the Eagles were running the shotgun before anybody even knew to call it the shotgun. I mean, I went back and I looked at some of their footage, and it's stunning, some of the things they did, some of the things he brought into the game, some of the pass coverage concepts, some of the pass routes. And, of course, he had Van Buren, and all he had to do was hand it to him. But in terms of the tactics and the X's and O's, Greasy Neal was way ahead of his time. And so I would say he was the best coach. And the other thing was his players really loved him. His players, when I interviewed his players over time, they had such affection for Greasy Neal. Because, and here's why. The makeup of that team was very unusual. It was a team of about half the guys were guys that had come back from the war. About half of the guys were war vets that had been away 3-4 years. I mean, Joe Muha, the fullback, fought the whole Pacific campaign with the Marines. Bednarik flew 40 combat missions on a B-24 bomber. Russ Kraft, the halfback, was in the Army and did the whole campaign through Europe and was one of the first guys to liberate the concentration camps. I mean, these were guys that had been through a lot. Okay, they had been through a lot in 4 years. They had just come back from fighting a war. And they hadn't picked up a football in a long time. And they came back and picked up their lives and were drafted and signed with the Philadelphia Eagles. Pete Pihos, the Hall of Fame end, was on the beaches at Normandy. So that was about half of your team, was you had these World War II vets. And the other half of the team were kids that really were now just coming out of college. So that's a real mixed bag of personalities. You got half the team are guys coming back from the war, really battle-hardened veterans that have seen a lot, and a bunch of kids just coming out of college ready to start their careers. And the coach had to put that all together. You talk about tough chemistry? That's tough chemistry. But the thing that Neal did, and every player to a man told me this, and one of the reasons why they loved him, was he understood what he was doing. He understood what that team was and what those players were. And he didn't have a curfew. He didn't have a bed check. He didn't have a lot of the rules that a lot of football coaches have. And he told them, he said, look, you guys that were all fighting a war for 4 years, you guys that were at Guadalcanal, you guys are not Normandy. Do I really have to tell you what time? Do I have to tuck you guys into bed at night? I don't think so. So he treated them like men. And for that, they respected him and they loved him. And they played hard for him. And that's, I mean, they had great players, but it's one of the reasons why they had those back-to-back world championships, because they had such great devotion and affection for their coach.
I hear so often from Eagles fans, the great frustration is, at least in these modern times, never winning the big one. That evasive big win is the one they want. Do you think that will always be the case until the day you're back in the Super Bowl and win the big trophy? Can you look at now this season, for instance, I'm a Kansas City Chiefs fan, so I know about this, where you just kind of have to take a decent season, a winning season, and be happy with it. But that's not what this town specializes in. We want it all, or that's it. 9-4 means nothing. We want it all. I mean, is that fair? Are we at a place now where if we don't win it, if Chip Kelly can't get it done, it's never going to be enough?
No, I think each person has to answer that for themselves. I mean, each person kind of feels different. You know, everybody has a different take on how satisfying a season is for you. Ultimately, obviously, the ultimate satisfaction is to win the whole thing. But short of that, then each person kind of has to determine, okay, this was good enough. But I think to answer your question fairly, no, these people want to win it all.
Yeah, right? You want to win it all.
Because here's the thing, and I have this discussion, no, not discussion, kind of borderline argument, with a lot of people, a lot of my friends around the league. You can't believe how much I defend you people out on the road, okay? You really owe me a big debt of thanks, because I have taken so many lumps for all of you folks. Now, I do it gladly, and I do it with a sense of justice, because at heart, I am one of you, and I understand where you're all coming from. But here's the thing. I can't tell you how many times I've traveled around the country and been in a group of sports writers, you know, the Tony Kornheiser, Skip Bayless types of guys, okay? And sitting at a table with them, and invariably they'll get started on the, oh, those Philadelphia fans. Man, there's no worse fans in sports than those Philadelphia fans. And then immediately this goes right into, yeah, they threw snowballs at Santa Claus. And so now, okay, this is the point for me to hitch up my pants and stand up and say, now, wait a minute, and argue your case. And here it is. In my view, there are no better fans than the Philadelphia fans. I really believe that. In the measure that I find the truest measure, which is devotion and loyalty, that's what fans are about. And you are the most devoted and loyal fans in the league because you have stuck with this team through all of these years, all of these disappointments, all of these terrible seasons, bad decisions, breakdowns, heartbreaks. You keep coming back. You hang in there. And that's what it's all about. And when people say, and I've heard them say, oh, but they turn on their teams and they're impatient. And I say, impatient? 1960 is the last time this team won anything. And if you look around the NFC East, and this is my bottom line argument to this. When you look around the NFC East, okay, and I don't mean to make this painful for you or rub any salt in your wounds. Washington Redskins, 3 Super Bowls. Okay. New York Giants, 4 Super Bowls. Dallas Cowboys, 5 Super Bowls. Okay. Philadelphia Eagles. Okay. It's the only team with an empty trophy case. Okay. And all you folks want is what everybody else already has. Okay. And there ain't nothing wrong with that. Okay. And maybe we're getting close to that. And I said the other day when I was on with Anthony, and I believe this from the bottom of my heart. If the Eagles ever win the Super Bowl, and God, I hope I'm here to see it. If the Eagles ever win the Super Bowl, it will be the biggest celebration in the history of sport.
You ready for the party? By the way, you ready for the party? Hey, we have... A lot of you have questions, and I thought the best time to ask questions with Ray was accompanied by my other favorite guest. And these two guys, Ray included, are probably the two guests every week we have on the show that I hear more about consistently week in and week out than anybody else. Ladies and gentlemen, CBS3 sports director and former NFL star Beasley Reese in the house. Come on up here, Bees.
Let me see if I can run. Somebody help me stop running. Hey, everybody. Thanks a lot for letting me be here, Ray and Chris.
What was your assessment of what Ray had to say? Particularly, now you played the game. Give us a brief rundown of your resume. You played years.
We don't need to talk about who I played for. You trying to get me beat up in the room?
Stronger, bigger, faster today than they were back in that 49
game.
Well,
I agree and I disagree with Ray. I think the difference is in the linemen, and maybe I can't give Ray the linebackers either. I think it's the linemen that are bigger, stronger, faster, and superior athletes. I'm 60 years old. I think at 6'2", 210 pounds, I would be a big safety in the NFL today. And I played with Lawrence Taylor with the Giants. He was 240, 250 toward the end of his career. I think he'd be a big, powerful linebacker today. I think at certain positions, running back, you go look at, I don't know, anybody you call out, Jim Brown, Gale Sayers, you know, all of those old guys had the numbers and the speed and the dexterity. If they played today, I think they would be effective players. The difference is, on my football team, I had one 300-pound offensive lineman on my football team. And so we get pushed straight down the street if we were to try to play today. I think the difference is in the linemen.
I love these questions. They're all fantastic. Ray, this is pretty good. Have you ever been offered an NFL job by this team or any other organization? Have you ever had the chance to go to work for the NFL?
I had a chance to go to work for the NFL back in 1973. I was a sports writer at the Philadelphia Bulletin at the time, and they were starting an operation out in Los Angeles called NFL Properties/Creative Services, which was going to be a publishing arm of the NFL. It was going to do books, and they were going to publish the game programs and all that stuff. They were going to standardize a lot of the NFL publishing, and they wanted to do it out of one shop in L.A. And so they offered me a job out there. I was going to go out as the number two man in NFL publications. And I was 25 years old. I was just young. It was a pretty attractive offer, actually. I'm from Philly, man. I didn't want to leave. And, you look back on decisions you make in your life and things you could have done. And I'm really glad I did what I did, because I wouldn't have still been here. I wouldn't have had my newspaper career. I wouldn't have had the run at NFL Films that I had. I'm real happy with my life. I really am. But as far as – a lot of people ask if I ever was offered a general managership. No. I mean, I have fun with the draft, and I have fun with the personnel, and I like to be my own amateur general manager. But no, no one has ever offered me that job. And at this point in my life, I don't think the phone's going to ring.
Guys, we talk with both of you guys about this all the time on the show. What has become increasingly it seems the NFL is part of the news cycle more regularly. Not just the sports cycle, but the news cycle. St. Louis Rams are making the news. Ray Rice is making the news. Is this league more headline-driven now than it's ever been before? I feel like it's making more national controversial news regularly. What's your opinion of that over the years, having played it and covered it?
You want to take that?
No, Ray, I don't want to take that. I prefer you take that, Ray. Obviously, I'm very disappointed in the news, most of the news that has been coming out off the field. When Ray Rice did what he did, I immediately said he should not be in our game. Everything I have in life is based on the National Football League, my great job in Philadelphia. I owe everything to the National Football League. And for somebody to disgrace the brand in that way was disturbing to me. And every time you see the really bad stuff, trust me, these guys are really upset, because we know the privilege that we had to play in the league. So, I'm right with you. When bad stuff happens, I am mad as hell, because I just don't want that associated with the NFL, because it's truly – and it's hard to believe me with the news cycles that we hear. 90% of these guys are great guys. They go home to a wife and some kids, and they are really good guys. And we are branded sometimes by, the small percentage of guys that are just, they'd be crazy. I don't care if they were working with you, if they were working someplace else, they would be crazy guys who do crazy things.
Is it because they're king of the mountain, Ray? Is it such a huge multi-billion-dollar industry now, it's kind of fun to take shots at the king of the mountain? Is that why it's constantly news?
The NFL is far and away the most visible, the most followed, the most popular professional league in the world. I mean, the Super Bowl is the biggest event. So the people who make up this league are in the biggest fishbowl of all fishbowls. And when guys make mistakes, when guys screw up, when guys break the law, I mean, immediately in today's, as you said, the 24-hour news cycle, it becomes headline stuff. But what I would say is what bothers me is the rush for people who have never been associated with the game, have never been close to the game, don't understand the game. The rush of all of these social commentary people that want to paint the whole league as a collection of sociopaths and bad people, and they're not. Beasley's been around the game a long time, played the game damn well, too. And I've been around it for 44 years. And I can tell you some of the finest men, some of the finest people I've ever met in my life are the people who coach and play this game. Okay, and that is the great majority of them. And so when people want to take the broad brush and paint the league as bad and wrong, I mean, listen, there are bad people in Congress. They're bad people in the Catholic Church. They're bad people in every walk of life. And they're bad people in the NFL. But the league itself isn't bad. The institution isn't bad, and the game isn't bad. I've never believed that. I'm never going to believe that. Unfortunately, I think too many people allow the headlines to make them think that, but I know it's not true.
Has there been more talk about a coach recently in terms of how he thinks, this kind of mad scientist perception of his coaching style, than ours? Chip Kelly. What is Chip Kelly's sports science techniques? Does it give us an edge is the question. And I guess I'd just add, he seems to be this enigma to a lot of people. You know, what's he doing back there? Is he a Bunsen burners and beakers and a white lab coat? And, that there's something extra special about his brain that's unique to the NFL. Do you see him that way?
I definitely do. I mean, I don't know about the Bunsen burners and the mad science. I don't know about that part. But he's unlike any coach that I've been around with the things that he's doing. And frankly, I needed to kind of see it work before I believed in it. I really did. I mean, a lot of the stuff that he brought with him was was way different than anything I had seen before. And I didn't know how pro players were going to buy into it or if they would buy into it at all. I mean, I didn't know how these guys were going to take to a practice pace the way they practice. Beasley, have you ever seen a team practice the way this team practices?
I looked at video today of their practice today. It was
unbelievable.
And it was the first time I saw it. We set a camera up. They would run a play, and I swear to you, he'd hand the ball to Shady, and within 2 seconds, Shady would take 2 steps. They'd line up again. Another play. Getting signals from the sideline. It is crazy to look at this video. I was like this. I was like, what? And listen, they do it on Sunday, and it's driving people crazy.
Now, Bees, I remember when he first got to town last year, I talked to you as a player, and I said, what do these guys that have been under Reed's leadership for so long, what do they think of the guy coming out of college? And if I remember correctly, you said there was a—I mean, they respected him, but there probably was this feeling of, you're from Oregon. Show me what you've got, right?
I'm sure. I know that is exactly how I felt, and I know the players, like all of us, were standing to see if they're going to make this. You know, we all saw Spurrier. We've seen guys come out of college and not do well. So I think we all took that stance.
Sure.
But there have always been innovators. You know, Ray talked to you about Greasy Neal and the things that he brought into the game. When I was drafted by the Cowboys, they weighed me underwater because fat floats. You know, he was the innovator in the 70s,
yeah.
And that's so.
Yeah,
you know, we're seeing another. Bill Walsh was, you know, genius innovator, a creator. And so we are lucky enough. And I was worried. Listen, if you've listened to me talk, you know I was a huge Andy Reid fan because I am respectful of his accomplishment in this town. So big fan. We got lucky. To go from a great coach to maybe an even greater coach, and I think the new innovator in the National Football
League. The one thing I would say is, I agree. Kelly's really smart. The way he talks, that's how fast his brain goes. I mean, as fast as he talks is a reflection of how fast thoughts are going through his head. He's a really smart guy, and he is ahead of the curve in a lot of respects. But why I think this thing has taken hold as quickly as it has is he's done something very smart with his players. Was a lot of the stuff he brought in was new. For sure it was new. I've never seen teams practice like this before. I've never seen a lot of this nutritional stuff and a lot of, you know, the monitors they wear. I mean, a lot of this is really new and was kind of odd to see the first time, especially for pro players that had never been exposed to it before. There is a sense of, who's the college guy? What's this? This isn't college football. It's pro football. But what Kelly did was, when he came in, all the stuff that he introduced, and a lot of it was new, he explained all of it. Every time he would do something, he would say, all right, fellas, we're going to do this, and here's why. It's going to make, you know, the practices, for example, the pace at which they practice. You know, we're going to practice faster than you've ever practiced before. Your tongues are going to be hanging out, but you know what? By the second half of the year, we're going to be the best conditioned team in the league. Okay? And all of this nutrition stuff, we're going to be giving you smoothies, and you're going to think that's pretty stupid. But it's all going to be tailored to each one of you, and it's all going to replenish everything you've lost on the field, and you're going to be stronger, and over the course of the season, you'll be healthier. Everything he introduced, he explained it to the players. And as opposed to typical football coaches that would just say, we're going to do this because I said so, okay? We're going to do it because I'm the coach. Chip didn't do that. Everything he introduced, he explained, this is what we're doing and why we're doing it. And when you understand why you're doing something, it's much easier for the players to buy into it. And that's one of the reasons why the players were on board right away, because they said, oh, okay, that makes sense. And now, trust me, they are fully on board.
Plus, I believe that all of those players want to be 12 years old. I mean, you can laugh at me if you want to. They want to be motivated. You know, they want to be, they want rah-rah. They want to play for a color. You know, they want to play for a town. I truly believe this. They want to be 12. They want to feel like they felt. You know, we all reach back for the best feelings. And there are studies that have been written about boys and girls at 12 years old. You know, the decisions you make in life. And I really believe these players want to be yelled at. They want to be pushed. They want to be challenged. They want to be motivated. And they want to feel like we're a band of brothers going after something. They really do. They really do.
It is almost a cliched question, but it does seem, and I was listening to WIP on the way in today, and it was, I mean, you know who they're talking about. Amazingly, this tremendous team of these really star athletes, but the obsession continues to be Sanchez. Sanchez. And is he the real deal? And will he end up choking? Will he end up costing it for us? And, by the way, a guy named Nick Foles, who was just on Sports Illustrated, who came out of nowhere and had this explosive season last year. And now it's Foles who? And I, what do you make of this? I think you both have said more or less that you see them in terms of talent as interchangeable figures. Is that true, or have I put words in your mouth?
I don't know if they're interchangeable because they're so different in their style. And Sanchez obviously has a lot more experience than Nick, but I don't know. People keep asking about this quarterback controversy. There's no quarterback controversy right now. You have one quarterback. Okay. Now there may be a quarterback controversy down the road. There may be a quarterback controversy next season. There may be a quarterback controversy in the next mini camp, but for now you have one quarterback who can play. Okay. And so it's Sanchez, and right now it's his ball, and it's going to be his ball for as long as he can carry it. You know, if Nick will probably be cleared to play, I would guess probably by the end of the regular season. He'll certainly be cleared to play when they get to the playoffs, and they will be in the playoffs.
And so are you saying Nick? Aha, yeah. No, that's exciting, but then here we have all this great mojo with Sanchez, and then you're saying, okay, Foles, welcome back.
If you get to the playoffs, Nick will be dressed, and Nick will be active. But if Sanchez gets you to the playoffs, you're not going back to Nick. I mean, at that point he'll have sat out for 8 weeks, 9 weeks, and now you're going to be playing playoff competition, the better teams. You can't bring a guy off the shelf when you've had another guy who's taken you to the playoffs. So no, if Sanchez gets you to the playoffs and stays healthy, it's his show, you know. And Nick will be there, and if something happens to Sanchez, he'll get a chance to play. But if they get to the postseason, and I'm confident they will, I think Sanchez is going to be the quarterback. So the idea of there being a controversy, that'll probably happen sometime, but it's not going to happen in this season.
I always say it's up to the player. You know, when we were talking about Michael Vick and Nick Foles, on Chris's show, I was saying it's up to Nick. Nick played so good that the coach wasn't even a part of the decision. He wasn't even in the room when they were deciding who was going to be the quarterback when a man went 27 touchdowns and just two interceptions. Nick took it. It's up to Mark Sanchez now. It's up to Mark. If Mark continues to win, continues to play well, Nick Foles will have nothing to say about it, and nor will the coach. That's the beauty of football. It's up to the player. Play. Play, Mark. Play.
I mean, I hate looking down the road like this, but don't you have to then? You look ahead to next season and you say, okay, they're both healthy, and then what?
I don't look that far ahead.
You don't?
No. I mean you're 9-3, you've got the defending world champions coming to town on Sunday. I hate to sound like a coach, but I'm not looking any further than that. I mean, the quarterback decision, I mean, yeah, you'll probably have to confront it at some point. But right now,
I'm
dealing with more immediate challenges. And the immediate challenge is, damn, Richard Sherman's coming to town. I think you got to fight your way through that one first before you start dealing with those other issues.
Did Mark sign, what type of contract did Mark sign? One-year contract. See, Mark might get his money and leave you.
Oh, so you think you'll see Sanchez start somewhere else?
I'm just saying, if he plays and plays them into the playoffs and plays them into the Super Bowl or something like that, it's going to cost a lot of money to keep him here, and there might be a team that'll say, this guy learned Chip Kelly's offense, the hottest offense in the league. He took it to the Super Bowl or deep into the playoffs. He's going to get paid and leave you.
I'd just love to know a show of hands from you guys. Maybe this is a kind of a perfunctory question, but a show of hands between these two guys, Sanchez or Foles, how many of you are now Sanchez believers, squarely Sanchez believers? All right. How many of you are believers in Foles and would like to see Foles return?
Okay.
And how many of you have little confidence in either? What do you make of that, guys? There are your Eagles fans. Tell me what you just saw. By the way, I felt like it was almost a third.
I think it was a third. Yeah. I'm honestly, if you had asked me to predict, that's exactly what I would have thought. Because with Sanchez, you have the history of how things went for him at the end in New York. And you know, you can't argue with the statistics. The guy's made a lot of mistakes and had some really bad games, but he also had some really good games early in his career. And I really think he's the kind of guy that if everybody else kind of does their job around him, I think he can do his. Nick, I think, has a lot of ability, a different kind of player, but he has a lot of ability, in my view. The way he played last year was so remarkably off the charts ahead of what anybody could have realistically expected for a first-year starter. I think it caused people to forget the very simple fact that he's a young quarterback. And young quarterbacks go through rough times, and young quarterbacks have things to learn, and it's going to be up and down. Well, Nick had his big up, and this year kind of things were bouncing back and forth, but it doesn't mean that he can't play, or I really don't believe. I've had some people say to me, last year was a fluke. No. A fluke can be a game, a couple of games. You don't have a fluke 27-2. That doesn't happen. You have to be able to play to do what he did last year. And I know there are a lot of people that are infatuated with the idea of drafting a quarterback. Everybody wants Marcus Mariota. He's going to be a top five pick in the draft. I don't know how the Eagles could realistically get up there to get him. I know Chip. Chip has been fascinated with Sanchez really from the beginning. He really is. Chip tried to recruit Sanchez out of Mission Viejo High School. Sanchez was a big-time player in high school in Mission Viejo. Chip tried to recruit him to Oregon way back then. Then he coached against him in the Pac-12. They have real history, these two guys. And so when Chip signed him, it wasn't like, well, we just need a backup quarterback who's available. Yeah, let's sign him. Chip wanted Mark Sanchez because he really believes in the guy. He knew he needed a fresh start, and he really saw the possibilities of this guy being able to run this offense. There's a genuine connection between those two guys. So Beasley's right. I mean, he'll probably, if he plays well, he'll have the opportunity to sign with other teams because he's on the one-year deal. But if he plays really well, and Lord knows, if he takes this team to a Super Bowl, he's not going anywhere.
Who is the star of this football team? Because I think for one of the rare times we have a winning football team that maybe you could argue the quarterback is not the star. Who's the star of the Philadelphia Eagles this season for you? Or I'll throw in on top of that, the most underappreciated or underrated that you would point to and say, now that guy, he's a linchpin.
I want to hear from Ray, so I'm going to go real quickly. Shady McCoy is the star of this team in my eyes because, and here's the reason, I have seen the trick before. Everybody else on the team, I saw what Connor Barwin, what he's done, NFC Player of the Month. I saw that before. I saw a guy to do that. I saw a guy play like Sanchez is playing. I think you got to go back to Gale Sayers and Barry Sanders to see some of the things that I saw, that I see with Shady McCoy. I think he's the odd factor. I think he's the unique talent. And if the offensive line is healthy, I think he's the guy that's going to take them to something huge this season.
And as a follow-up just on that, and this is, you know, the sports talk world, I hear some of my colleagues in sports talk, they like to discuss, are his better days behind him? Obviously, your answer would indicate no, you don't think so.
No, I don't think so. Right. In 6 years, he's 48 yards away from setting the all-time Philadelphia Eagles franchise rushing record. So I don't know about losing a step, and maybe those people still asking that question didn't see the Cowboys game. I mean, this man, it is a offensive line. For the running back, it truly is the offensive line. That's the reason they take him to dinner and buy him gold watches. And yeah, listen, they know who, when he was honored after the Cowboys game, he had the line behind him.
Sure did,
Ray?
Sure did.
They know where it is. They can't do it by themselves. And this line has been so up and down that, yeah, he had some bad games.
What you saw, people ask me a lot about McCoy as he lost it. When he had that stretch early in the season, no, he did not even close. I mean, he's still a great. He's 26 years old. I mean, the idea of him losing it was everything had to do with the offensive line. I don't think people really fully grasp how important the offensive line is to a running back. The confidence that he has or doesn't have in those guys in front of him. What you saw on Thanksgiving Day with him against Dallas, it was all about his belief that he had his guys back. You know, that stretch play that they run to the left, you know, when he gets Kelsey pulling and he gets Mathis pulling and he's got Peters blocking, pushing the edge. That's the play that they killed teams with last year. That's the play that he won the rushing title with last year. They tried to run it earlier this year, but when he had, and this is not a knock on Tobin and Kelly and Mulk, but they're backup players. And when they would call the same play and they would run the same play, but McCoy ran it entirely differently because the timing was different, and he didn't trust those guys the way he trusts these guys. So that's why when people say, well, he's always stopping, he looks uncertain, he wants to cut back, it's because he doesn't believe the hole's going to be where it's supposed to be. Now that he's got his guys, now that he knows I got Mathis coming out, I got Kelsey coming out, I got Peter, I got big Jason on the edge, now he knows where the hole's going to be. So he's hitting it harder, he's hitting it straighter, he's not looking to cut back now because he knows it's right in front of him. That's everything in the NFL. And getting his offensive lineman back is going to make all the difference in the world in this guy. Now, he's not going to win the rushing title because he's got too much ground to overcome. But I think what you saw on Thanksgiving Day is more indicative of what you're going to see the rest of the year because all the pieces of this offense are now coming back together again.
Looking ahead, I think it's only because they have that trophy that people seem nervous about the Seahawks. But I don't see them as the better team. Do you? So I'll close with this, and then we'll turn it over to your book signing. Talk to us about Sunday and what you see. That's not a better football team than ours, is it?
I'm not sure, and I'm not sure for the following reasons. I think their cornerbacks are really good. The NFL has stripped these guys down to 5 yards. The Eagles cornerbacks don't use their 5 yards. I'm very disappointed in the way that they play. They line up in a bump and run, and then they start backing up immediately and allow the receiver to dictate the route. That's not what you're going to see from Sherman and those guys. Those guys are going to stone guys at
sure.
the line of scrimmage, and they are going to dictate. So now we're going to find out about Mark Sanchez in this game. He's going to have to throw into very tight windows. The timing is going to be different because this is a superior defense that he's going to face. I'm just trying to tell you the truth. Don't start looking sad at me. Don't start saying, Beasley, would you leave? I'm trying to tell you the truth. And the X factor, this kid Wilson does not have the stature of a Aaron Rodgers in the pocket. He does not have the flashy pre-snap movements and verbiage of a Peyton Manning. But let me tell you what he does.
Uh-oh.
He changes that 3.5 seconds that most quarterbacks generally have to get rid of the ball into 5, 7, even sometimes like 9 seconds through his slippy, rodent-like ability to survive in a pocket long enough to give his guys. And our guys can't cover, no cornerback, no DB can cover for 6 or 7 seconds. So those are the issues. Now, can Chip and Billy Davis overcome them? They have been so far. They're 9-3, and I believe they will.
It's going to be a big challenge. I mean, we all know they're the defending champs. We saw what they did last year.
They're not them, though, right?
They're getting there. They're getting there. Early in the season, they sort of staggered around a little bit, and people were saying, typical year after the Super Bowl, you know, year after the Super Bowl malaise, it's setting in. Well, no, they had a lot of injuries early in the season, and they lost a couple guys, as always happens to Super Bowl teams. They lost some guys to free agency. And you know what, Beasley? You know, this is just my theory, but I really think the Percy Harvin thing really derailed them for a while. You know, Percy Harvin is a great player. But he's a handful. I mean, he's a tough guy to coach. He's a tough guy to manage. He's a tough guy to have in your locker room. And they tried the first half of the year, it looked to me watching film of them, they tried all kinds of ways to kind of build the offense around him, to try and keep him happy. And that isn't really what the Seahawks are. They aren't really a finesse, you know, flanker reverse kind of team. But to keep Percy Harvin happy for the price they paid for him, they kind of tried to reinvent themselves as that kind of team. And when they got to midseason and they just decided, you know what, let's just get rid of the guy. He's a headache. They got rid of him, and they became a much better team. By losing a really good player, they became a much better team. they kind of went back to being what they are, which is Marshawn Lynch and Russell Wilson and pounding the rock, you know, and playing off their defense. And I think the trade of Harvin, in retrospect, even though they didn't get anything back for him really, and a lot of people said they took a beating on it, well, what they did was they kind of got back to being the team that they needed to be. So now, the second half of the year, they're playing much, much more like the team that won the Super Bowl. And the Eagles are going to have their hands full. If they're going to have to play as good as they played Thanksgiving Day, they're going to have to play better on Sunday to
beat
this team.
Will they win, Ray?
I think they will.
Beasley, will they win?
No, I absolutely positive. I try to tell you the truth now. I believe it's going to be a tough game, but I think they will win the game. I think the home field advantage, I think the way they're rolling, I think everything's perfect. Everything's right in front of the Eagles right now. I picked them to be a Super Bowl team in the offseason. The signing of Darren Sproles was the difference maker for me. When they got that guy in here as another most dangerous man, you can stop one dangerous man. You can stop maybe two dangerous men. They brought Sproles in here. I thought that just turned this team into something that can really be special. And I believe they'll win this game. I believe they'll run the field. I think they'll run the table. They're going to run the table.
Well, that's,
look out.
Because they have to run the table.
Now they're 13-3 then.
They have to run the table because, okay, who wants to go to Green Bay? Raise your hand. Raise your hand if you want to go to Green Bay. They need to run the table. I think that's what they're going to do.
I mean this sincerely, that Monday through Friday, we do five shows a week, and the two that I most look forward to are my Mondays and Fridays, because at 8 o'clock on each of those days, I get to talk to these two guys. Ladies and gentlemen, Beasley Reese and Ray Didinger.
The Chris DeGaulle Show.
Talk Radio 1210.
WPHD.